opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Inspirational women are increasingly popular in the news and media, but many go unheard and their stories are never told. Women to Watch with Susan Rocco captures the stories of many women who truly make a difference. Women to Watch is the vehicle for developing new leaders, encouraging younger generations, and in building self-esteem for future entrepreneurs.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch here on WWDB Talk 860 and womentowatch.net. My name is Sue Rocco, and we're going to have a wonderful show this afternoon. I have two women joining us. We have our monthly financial contributor at the top of the show this afternoon, Kristen Hilsley, who is a financial advisor with Robert W. Baird. And our guest following Kristen will be Trish Costello, who is the CEO and founder of Portfolia, an entrepreneurial investing group designed for women. Before we get started, I want to give out our website, which is womentowatch.net. That's women, the number two, watch.net, N-E-T, where you can find our wonderful lineup of guests that we have scheduled through May, I believe, right now. And if you're listening to the show and you'd like to call in with questions, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so by dialing 888-329-3306. That's 888-329-3306. So let's get started with Kristen, who's going to be talking to us about re-entering the workforce. Kristen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sue. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. This is a great topic. You know, what to know about re-entering the workforce, kind of relaunching careers. And I know you have some great tips for our listeners around this.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because this is a very big financial topic as well as a personal topic. So it's something that I wanted to bring about. I mean, I'm not necessarily an HR expert or anything along those lines, but what I can tell you is that when I study the current state of the challenges that women face when it comes to their finances, on average, women spend about 12 fewer years in the workforce for family caregiving responsibilities than our male counterparts. And women are also twice as likely as men to work part-time. So these statistics tell us something financial about women, and that is that if you are working less years, chances are your Social Security benefits will probably be lower than your male counterpart. And the same thing with if you're working part-time, that can lower your Social Security benefit. So, too, if you're working in a job, which I know is a little more rare today, but with a pension, it can also lower the number of hours that you've put in for your pension benefits. And also with a 401k or a 403b, the less years you're working, the less money that you're putting away for retirement. So even though it's kind of a personal issue, it's also a big financial issue because in the end, we want to be able to hit that retirement finish line and feel really comfortable that we have all of the assets that we need to take us through retirement without having that anxiety that we might not have enough. So it's a really important issue, and I have a lot of dear friends that have stayed home and taken care of family members, or I have other family members that have had to stay home to take care of loved ones. And one of the things that you kind of have to decide when you're ready to go back is, what do you want to go back to? I've not had a chance, I never stayed home, but I can only imagine that when you're going back, you want to decide, do I want to go back full-time? Am I ready for that? Do I want to go back part-time? Or do I maybe want to take, maybe I had a certain role when I first started, and maybe I'm comfortable taking a step back so I can have less days in the office and I'm comfortable having less responsibility as well. The other big thing that's important is networking. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go to every event and hand out every single business card to every person with two hands. But what it does mean is that you have to kind of think thoughtfully about people that are in your family, in your social circle, in your, you know, in your church or things that you do for fun. Talk to people and tell them. I mean, this is a little bit of a different example, but I remember, you know, I started out my career in healthcare. And I ended up going back to school for my MBA, which is when I decided I wanted to transition into finance. And I told every person that I could possibly tell that I wanted to become a financial advisor. And it was a family friend who ended up introducing me to my former partner, the first person that I worked with when I became a financial advisor. So you never know who's going to know and, you know, someone that you might want to meet. The other thing that we do every year, and you have been such an amazing part of this, is our Women's Lifestyle Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been, maybe even you have felt the same way, it's been a great source for women to just connect to one another. And I've heard a lot of wonderful career changes and just people getting to know one another.
Well, I always think when women get together, you know, in that kind of a forum, there's always opportunities that come about from that. And often, you know, you're starting out talking about personal things with people, but inevitably, if you start to mention, you know, career or job or something you're looking for, you will get an introduction.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Tell me about setting boundaries, something that you mentioned in your prep work for this, that it's important to, you know, prioritize your financial needs, but setting boundaries.
Sure. You know, it's so hard to set boundaries sometimes. And, you know, sometimes a boundary might be a personal boundary, or like I said, you know, how much time you actually want to go back to work or not go back to work. But financial boundaries are really important as well. Once that paycheck starts coming in, it is so great to have, you know, prior to you working, it's so great to have certain goals in place. And that means different things for different people. So I, for example, have one client that's been with me for a really long time. She's retired, and she has an emergency fund set up, but she funds it based on potential emergencies, you know? So it's like the car breakdown emergency fund, the healthcare breakdown emergency fund, and so on and so forth. But in general, she knows that in her mind, her goal is, I just don't want to worry if any of these things happen. The other thing, too, is putting that financial plan together. So you might put a financial, you know, you might have all the intentions in the world of only working part-time, but you might put your financial plan together. And I might say, hey, you know, you could retire a year earlier if you worked full time, or you could, you know, there's a whole host of goals that people might have. You might need to put one of your children through college, and it might be better to work and be able to pay that off rather than, you know, to have to take out loans and things along those lines. So prioritizing your own retirement first, your own emergency savings first, and making sure that, you know, those credit cards, debt, things like that, just do not creep in there, because those can be a recipe for disaster.
Do you have any advice? I'll just ask you this last question. You know, if someone, sometimes women are thinking about going back, but to an entirely different field. So mm-hmm. That's, you know, that's always a stressor. Maybe they don't go back to what they knew. They want to try something brand new.
I think that's something beautiful, and it really should be embraced. I mean, I think, you know, if we look at the historic nature of careers, people, you know, you might have been a carpenter, you might have been a baker. Those aren't necessarily things that you would have stopped doing at 59 and a half or at 62, but enter into like the industrialization of the United States, and people start thinking about retirement as a date, because that's when their pension begins or that's when Social Security begins. But the beauty of the direction that society is going now is that we are starting to be able to reinvent ourselves.
Yes.
So you might be able to do that financial plan, and you may be able to find out that for the first time, yes, I can accept a volunteer, a paid position with a nonprofit organization where I know I'm not going to be making as much as maybe I did before, but I sure know that it's going to feel a lot better inside. So again, we can really create any outcome that we want if we have a good financial plan in place. It's just when the numbers don't work that maybe some other maybe more tough decisions have to be made.
Yes. Well, hopefully, and this is what I'm going to be talking to Trish about in just a moment, I hope that women will be in a position, they will have invested wisely and saved and planned so that then perhaps later they can be investing in other women's endeavors. So the young, the next generation coming up, the next entrepreneurial generation and do, you know, explore a little bit and do some research about investing in other companies. That will be, you know, that's just going to contribute for all of us.
I agree. I really look forward to listening to that conversation. I think that's wonderful.
Okay. Well, Kristen, thank you so much for stopping in as usual. And if anyone's listening and wants to be in touch with you, what is your web address?
They can reach us at FH for Foley Hilsley Baird.com. So it's FH Baird, BAIRD.com.
Okay, great. Thanks, Kristen. We'll talk
Thank
to you,
you
soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Now I'd love to welcome to the show Trish Costello. And Trish is the CEO and founder of Portfolia, which is an entrepreneurial investing group designed particularly for women. Trish, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sue. Great to be here.
So great to have you. I was doing a little bit of extra research this morning and reading about the work you're doing, and I just have so many questions for you. It's such an exciting time for women in business, and so I think your insight's going to be really valuable for our listeners. I would love to start with your growing up years, though, and find out a little bit about the young Trish Costello and, you know, what some of the things were that helped to shape the drive that you have today. So talk to me a little bit about your early years growing up in Kansas.
Well, it would not be the kind of background that would predispose me to later creating an investing and unique investing platform for women. I grew up in a farm town in what they would call Little Pittsburgh, in that it was named after, of course, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, because it was a mining town.
Okay.
But actually there in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, I grew up, as I said, in a farming community, was the first in my family to go to college. But my father was kind of a social entrepreneur. He was the head of the volunteer fire department. He helped build the Little League sports fields. He taught himself to write federal grants and actually was able to raise money to build housing for the elderly in this little tiny community. So I was able to see early, Sue, that you could start with nothing but a great idea and find ways to access dollars and other types of help and actually create something just out of a good idea.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great example to grow up to. And did you actually grow up on a farm or in a farming town?
My father was a baker.
Okay.
In a farming town. My grandfather was a farmer, so I've been on a farm, been on the farm many times, but we had moved into the city. We were city kids.
You were city kids. Okay. And how about Mom? Did she work outside of the home?
You know, Mom worked outside of the home in the same way that many moms in the 50s did. She worked as a bookkeeper. She worked in a restaurant. So not in any kind of professional capacity, but both of my parents were very, very hard workers and had had a vision for what they wanted their family to, you know, to be like and how they wanted, you know, us to develop and grow and have the freedom to make our own decisions.
You know, I often hear when women or men are the first in the family to go to college, that's really very celebrated. Would you say that, you know, education was, that message for you was very strong growing up, that, you know, in order to really be able to be successful, that you had to complete your education?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. That was always the expectation. And we had the kind of support that we needed to do that. And it was not, you know, at the time that I was going to college, thankfully, it wasn't so terribly expensive. And it wasn't like you were saddled for the rest of your life with education debt either. Mm. That's one thing I do worry about today, is that we put such a burden on our children.
Yes.
Too often when they want to get education.
Yeah, it is. It's a big problem today. You went and attended Pittsburgh State University, and you were named Outstanding Woman Graduate, and you were also Student Body President. So that says to me that, you know, right off the bat, you were, someone who was seeking leadership positions.
My gosh, Sue, I can't believe you found those old facts from, 35, 40 years ago. That would be 40 years ago now.
Okay.
About this time. So
yeah, yeah.
1978 was when I graduated.
Yeah.
I think it was one of those where, as I said, I had seen a lot of leadership in my family, and had gone to high school in a very small, high school that did not, at the time, was not focused on academics. It was focused on, football and sports, and girls weren't, in my high school even expected to go to college. So when I went to college, even in my 5,000 person state school, the opportunities just seemed to me that the world was, was at my feet, that as long as I worked hard and had big dreams and kept a vision in mind, that I could achieve anything. And that's where I really put a lot of, give a lot of credit to my state university there, because they really, they saw a bright young woman and just wanted to, let me go as far as I could. And it was a wonderful experience.
So tell,
I try to go back there when I'm back home seeing my family.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Tell me what your dreams were then in college, because I'm assuming that at that age, you didn't know that one day you would be starting this company that would be investing in women, but there was probably an evolution. What was the beginning?
Mm-hmm. Well, we actually, at that point, I knew I wanted to be in business in some way.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting an accounting degree. I knew that business would be in my future. I actually started a small business with my sister right out of college. So I did go to work for Southwestern Bell and AT&T. Which was a major hirer of young grads at the time. But on the side, we started a daycare center. This is still fairly new. And the big exits, La Petite Academy, KinderCare, were both companies that were venture-backed, that were being grown in those days when daycares were being expanded across the country. And we had a little daycare. And so we were actually in a space even, way, way back in the early days, that was a high potential opportunity. Now, my sister's 4 or 5 years younger than I am. So we were not very old. She was probably still in her teens and I was 23, 24 years old. And when we started, our first little daycare.
Wow.
Brother and I later were in a business. Mm-hmm.
Is that right? The daycare, Trish, was when you after graduation? Or while you were in college? Okay.
Yeah, shortly. No, she was in college, but it was a couple of years after I graduated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I made a little bit of money. I thought I was rich because, you know, I had a managerial job. I was hired out of school in one of those training programs where they, you know, your first day you come in and they say those six people report to you. And, you know, this is how we're going to train you to be a manager. But I lived very frugally, and so that was, that was the investment capital that we used for our little daycare center. We bought, you know, we didn't know, we bought a little house in our community.
Wow!
It actually didn't even have inside. It didn't even have inside plumbing. So my father actually plumbed the house.
Oh my gosh!
And it became kind of a whole family affair.
Wow!
Building that that little daycare center.
Wow!
But it was the start of something really amazing. And again, it was that you come up with an idea, a concept, you research it,
mm-hmm.
you take the pieces apart, and you you make it happen.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we see that so often with immigrants as well. Is that you have to be you have to be resilient, but you also have to be so creative. You know, you have to make things work for yourself. And I think that's good training.
It is. And, you know, the other thing I think is things are not always going to go the right direction. So tell me how you, when things go awry, what is your mantra? What kind of keeps you moving through the tough times?
I think the most important thing is that, I know to expect ups and downs. I know that a dip isn't a downturn. A dip is just a challenge. And that you just keep moving through it, taking things apart, trying to figure out next steps, you know, having that plan B. There are times that you need to pull the plug or you need to reevaluate, but even that's not a failure. When you're looking at it to get the learning from it, and you're building your next, opportunity on top of it.
I guess that it's just a pivot, and right? A new direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
It is a new direction. And, there's so many areas that we can build and improve on in the world. And I think that's one thing that I think is also, very exciting very excited about how women think. Shortly after the daycare center, a number of years later, we were in the middle of an earlier piece of the women's movement. And, I helped start one of the first battered women's shelters in Kansas City at that time. And actually left my job at AT&T and led that battered women's shelter as the executive director for 2 years. And I'd have to say that I learned so much about entrepreneurship from running that women's shelter, because again, it was tackling a huge challenge, a social challenge. It was all about marketing. About enabling people and sales, enabling people to understand both the problem and that there were solutions. It was quite unusual at that point. Rape crisis centers and better women's shelters were just starting. And to also be able to, with a nonprofit with very little money, figure out how to recruit top people and how to incent them and bring them together as a team when you did not have money as a resource, like I did at AT&T. And I would say that was one of the highlights of a business experience, in my first 20 years. because of the deep expertise and the challenges. And, you know, that battered women's shelter, Rosebrook Center, you know, is still now it's in a gigantic home and still operating, still helping women and still a pillar of the community.
That's wonderful. Were you partnering with others at the time to help these women, you know, beyond being at the shelter and kind of creating a life for themselves?
Well, yes. In fact, we built out all types of programs. We ended up, getting state money for alcohol and drug dependencies. You know, we ended up partnering with people that were dealing with homeless issues because that, you know, was a part of it. We actually went very deep and started unpacking what all of the issues were around women's inability at the time to, you know, move out of abusive situations. You know, I had the one of the top people in the police department on my board because we knew we needed to educate the police. We had people from the religious community. And I want to, you know, I also want to say, this is, you know, kind of one of these important shout outs. The majority of women that were building these programs and making a difference in the world were lesbian women. I was a young married woman at the time, but it was the real leaders that came out early and put their names there were women that very often were lesbian and had a lot of fear, should have had a lot of fear and knew because their children could be taken away from them or they could lose their jobs. I mean, that was in the very early days, so not in a world where we live today.
Right.
And those women, many of them, they're still dear, dear friends. You know, I look at that and say, if it weren't for their courage, you know, we don't often really appreciate and thank lesbian women for changing rape, creating rape crisis centers and things like this. They were on the front lines.
Yep.
And I followed them, and they were my guiding star.
Wow, and you're right. You know, it's very courageous to be doing that at a time when, you know, there would be a lot of criticism coming back on you to be able to speak out and make a difference.
We learn, you know, it's a, you know, if we want to be entrepreneurs, if we want to create in business, we can often find these experiences that masquerade as different things, masquerade as social services or even masquerade as corporate. And in those early years, what I tell a lot of the young women that I mentor is, you know, these early years, it's all about finding that experience that lets you stretch and grow and test yourself. And look for those, you know, even in ways where it initially may be hidden to you.
Mm. Tell me how you came to be a co-founder of the Kauffman Fellows Program.
Mm-hmm. So I had, you know, had gone through this, had started the battered women's shelter and then moved on and joined a founding team to create companies in the children's health space. That was Child Health Corporation of America. We were venture-backed. We were co-owned by a number of children's hospitals who invested in our company and started creating products for children, medical, education. I ran Children's Health Network, which was the children's health network, the parenting and accredited medical education delivered by satellite. Sue, this is way before internet or about the time of internet, but before it was something that individuals or businesses were able to use. It was still the internet was still used in research, only research that time.
Yeah.
And so it was all satellite delivered education. As I said, medical education as well as parenting and others. We would actually go in and do high level, we would film, you know, high level brain, you know, surgery and organ transplants in the pediatric world, and then send them out to all of the other physicians around the world who wanted to learn how to do, you know, these very high level types of, you know, medical procedures. We did very well with that company. I was there for 6 years, and all the other, you know, number of companies that came out of our work. And so that was kind of that movement where I really went into a fast growth entrepreneurial company that really made that shift. And we were able to, you know, we were the largest provider of pediatric home health care. We created the concept of home health care, you know, everything from prosthesis for babies and wheelchairs for little children customized for them was all a part of our product lines. So that really was, you know, was a, you know, a major experience for me. And then I had my own two little babies. I had twins mm-hmm. In 1990. And opted to stay home for a little bit with them and sold my equity share in the company and was at home with my children when Ewan Kaufman passed away and left almost $2 billion to be used by the Kaufman Foundation to create really a whole new ecosystem for entrepreneurs. That did not exist at the time, Sue. The idea of the importance of entrepreneurs and the importance of startups was really not a common view in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the IRS put a whole team of agents on it because they thought that it could be that the foundation might be trying to create some kind of scheme where they were taking nonprofit money and putting it into for-profit, you know, companies. And so they gave us a period of time to show that what we were doing was socially redeeming, the exact words. And in fact, you know, the rest of this is, I think, fairly well known that, you know, we now know today that entrepreneurship and innovative startup growth companies are where nearly all of the new jobs come from. Nearly all of the new technology comes from this work. And so, you know, it seems, you know, quaint that just early in the 90s that that wasn't the case, but it is true. And so because I had been in a fast growth startup company, because we had been venture backed and in fact had our own little venture fund, it made me in Kansas City a local expert in venture capital. So they sought me out. And I joined the team, the startup team at the Kaufman Foundation, and was challenged with creating a new training program, something that had never existed, creating a training program to basically create new venture capitalists that would back in the technology world, that would back rising, you know, entrepreneurs.
Wow. That's amazing. And were your children, you have twins, right, Trish? So how old were they when you were sought out to do this?
I think they were 3 years old at the time.
Oh my gosh.
And so they were still quite young.
Yeah. Yeah. You're talking about it very nonchalant,
They were raised in the business.
Right.
They were raised in the business. They'd be little tiny girls sitting in the back of some big meeting room, you know, listening to the top VCs in the world talk about this, you know, how you evaluate companies and, you know, through the years and now many years later, Sue, my daughters are now 27 years old and both of them are with venture-backed companies in San Francisco and have been with multiple venture-backed companies.
Wow. I love that. I love that.
It's a family.
Yeah. Well, they saw by, you know, they witnessed by example and learned that way from you. It's tremendous. Listen, we have to take a quick break for our sponsors. When we come back, I want to get right to the catalyst for founding Portfolia. We'll be right back.
This is Kristen Hilsley, financial advisor of the Foley Hilsley Group, with a big announcement. Last fall, I hosted a women's lifestyle conference to help the women who do it all take control of their finances. Now I'm excited to announce a new partnership with Women to Watch Media to help show women how to own their financial future. We'll have newsletter articles, blog posts, announcements of live events, and a lot more, all available at womentowatch.net and our own website, foleyhilsleygroup.com. I'm thrilled about this new partnership, and I look forward to being your resource for all things financial. Stay tuned to learn more or visit our website at FoleyHilsleyGroup.com. The Foley Hilsley Group is affiliated with Robert W. Baird & Company, member SIPC. Log on to FoleyHilsleyGroup.com to learn more. That's FoleyHilsleyGroup.com or call 610-238-6636.
Since 1858, Mount St. Joseph Academy has been educating girls to be leaders, founders, and independent thinkers. Students are taught to be collaborative, courageous, compassionate, confident, and spiritual. In this student-centered environment, the young women are transformed by recognizing their own potential and are encouraged to use it to make a difference in the world. To learn more about Mount St. Joseph Academy, go to www.msjacad.org or call 215-233-3177. That's msjacad.org or 215-233-3177. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Women to Watch. My name is Sue Rocco, and I'm joined this afternoon by Trish Costello. And Trish is the CEO and founder of Portfolia. And I want to, you know, have you just describe the very moment it, you know, you made the decision to start this investing group and how it came to be.
Yeah. So what happened with this, Sue, is that I left the venture industry for a couple of years and, had taken a little bit of a break and did a couple of other things and then came back and was really able to see a lot of things with fresh eyes. And the most important piece of this, Sue, was that women really were not able to move into venture capital as venture capitalists themselves, professional investors. They were starting to become angel investors, so individual investors in companies, but we weren't really seeing a movement of women into the space. And why that's so important, Sue, is that all of the innovative companies, all of the innovative products that are really getting scaling fast and really changing our world. Well, we know this from Facebook just name it, all of these, you know, major companies that are out there that impact our daily lives, they are all run by men and they are financed by men. I had tried to change that when I was at Kauffman Fellows. I tried to change that at Kauffman Foundation, funding some of the most innovative women's groups and organizations that were working in the space. But what I had initially done is through Kauffman Fellows, worked within the venture capital system itself. When I came back, what I realized is it's fine to work within a system, but if you really want to make major changes in the world, you really need to disrupt what's happening. You really need to think way out of the box. And so I started researching this. I knew how the system worked probably better than anybody because I had worked with hundreds of venture capitalists. So I took as my challenge, Sue, that I was going to take the venture capital investing process. I was going to deconstruct it. And the challenge I gave myself is that this is a design challenge. How do you recreate the venture investing process in a way that completely works to the advantage of the woman as an investor? How do we organize? You know, left to our own devices, how do we organize? How do we make decisions? How do we add value? How do we communicate? And so I basically recreated the process of investing in a way that I thought would not only be attractive and engaging to women, but that would give us a unique competitive advantage to this old traditional system that's out there now, that's 95% men, that's relatively unchanged since the 1950s. How do we recreate it in a way that we become powerful forces in the investing world? So that's what portfolio is all about.
Mm. Wow. That's amazing to me that you just kind of dove in and dug deep. And I love that word disrupt that you used, because I think that's so very true. In order to really have impact, sometimes you have to completely change direction in an area. One of the things, when I think about, you know, the difference, like what are these differences between men and women that kind of hold women back? And you had shared a statistic that 40%, there was a 40% gap in confidence, data shows, between men and women. And women have the knowledge and the know-how and the ideas. How can we, you know, how can we get women to have more confidence in their ideas?
Yeah, so, you know, I think what a lot of it is when you're looking at women as investors is that you have to give them the format that works for them. And I'll give you an example. You know, when we read, when we work out or when we read books, we often don't see that as a singular pursuit. Or when we lose weight, you know, we see that as something that we do with other women that we trust and care about. We work out, we have workout partners, or we go to, you know, workout groups that, you know, that do circuits. So when we read books, we love to be in book clubs. How many men do you think are in book clubs? You know, it's teeny. It doesn't mean they don't even exist, you know? And so many, many things like investing, like reading, like working out, are more individual pursuits when men do them. When we do it, it's a community. And so to put the expectation on a woman that investing is a singular pursuit already makes her uncomfortable. And so it's really taking what happens in the investing world and saying, we're not going to only teach women financial literacy. We're not going to teach them the words that have been used, you know, or created by men, or teach them with the system and shoehorn them into a system that was built for others. We're going to modify the system to make them comfortable, to make it enjoyable, to make it valuable. And that's the root. I think women, if you know, in the right environment, are just as comfortable with risk. It's just that you're putting them in an environment they're not comfortable with.
Mm. So if I understand it, the model for portfolio is to be, you're investing in multiple companies. So you're putting your money into a fund that is going to benefit
right.
multiple companies. Is that correct?
That's correct, Sue. And so that's such a good example, because it is very risky when you're investing in one company, or you're going to put all your money, let's say you're going to take, you know, 50 or 100,000 for that year and put it in one company. That is highly risky.
Yes.
Even if you're putting 10,000 in one company, that's highly risky. We know, you know, if we were going to invest in, you know, even the public stock market, you wouldn't just buy one type of stock.
Right. Yes.
It's tricky. But
right.
that's the practice in, you know, early stage investing. You know, you just have enough money to put in one or two companies. What we know is that if you invest in 6 to 9 companies in a year, you are going to have a much higher probability of making a return. That's why venture capitalists do it that way. But, you know, what if you want to invest in a venture fund? You need to put up, you know, $2 million. And even very wealthy women are nervous about that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not a part of that world. And so what I did is create an opportunity for you to put $10,000 in a venture fund. And that money spread out across 6 to 9 companies
mm-hmm.
in a particular vertical. So you could pick active aging, or you might be interested in consumer or enterprise companies or femtech. And you can pick your space.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have professional investors in each of those funds from around the country. And they are constantly looking at what are the coolest, most amazing new companies that are coming out. With the best entrepreneurs and teams.
Mm-hmm.
And we then diversify that money over the next 12 months in that vertical with those companies. And so, you know, will some companies die? Absolutely. But we're giving a unique opportunity to be in an early stage investing private companies, but spread out for a small amount of money spread out across all of those companies, and to make it really engaging. And because we know, you know, women love to be educated. We want to know more. So I created it as Learn by Investing Funds. So all of our individual investors, and we'll take 99 in each fund, they can be as involved as they like, or they can be as passive. So if you're busy and you've got a bunch of little kids or it's summertime and you don't have time, you just read the quarterly reports if you like. But if you have the time and you're really excited about being in the FemTech fund, then you can come on every month and watch the companies that are pitching. You can ask them questions. You can be on the due diligence team. You can be completely involved. You can't make the final decision because it's managed. It's managed by a group of professionals that make the final decisions, but you can be involved with every step, and you can help make those companies successful.
Yeah.
So it's really a completely different way.
It's wonderful and it's exciting. I would think that women would want to, as much as they can, be involved and be a part of it. We're seeing such a renaissance of entrepreneurship, and particularly among women. I'm just wondering your opinion. How does a woman decide really if entrepreneurship is right for her? Because I don't know that it is the best for everyone.
Yeah, you have to have the fire in the belly. You really need that. And you have to want to be building something that you think can't be built by somebody else, that really plays to your passion. You know, and there's two kinds of entrepreneur, multiple kinds of entrepreneurship. You know, you can have the little shop, down the street that you want to, the dress shop.
Sell
that
your
you
wares.
Want to manage and maybe, sell your wares, maybe pass it on to your a family member later.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could, think about a new way of selling clothes and want to create something that you think is going to be a national, or a global brand.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the Real. That's a, great example. My friend, Julie Wainwright, so it's like consignment. You can create a little consignment store mm-hmm. in your neighborhood, or you can do what Julie Wainwright has done, which is create a multi-billion dollar
yes.
consignment empire with the Real Real.
Yeah.
And which of those you want to be is complete. I mean, that's like, completely different on how you would find money or, the kind of challenges or requirements that takes. There used to be an old saying at Kauffman Foundation, actually built on a very reliable statistic, that said that we are as likely to start a business as we are to have a child. So it's just what version of that starting a business do you want to do?
Mm. And that's so interesting. It's not a matter of right or wrong either. How big you want to go or how small and simple you want your life to be. It really is such a very, very personal choice.
Absolutely. And there's different times in our lives that, we can move in and out of, any of those different ways. I mean,
that's right.
The daycare center was a little tiny operation in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Portfolio. I intend in Portfolio to have over 100,000 women investing in our venture funds by 2022 for an average of about $15,000 a year. And Sue, that will be $1.7 billion
wow.
that year going into the companies we want in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And so, even for small amounts, we could be a juggernaut in the whole innovation, ecosystem. So we can, many of us are going to try all kinds of channels of this entrepreneurship world. It's so creative. We can operate anyway, but that's our goal. Our goal is to shift completely, how we see our money, how we use our money.
Tell me how you came up with that specific goal, 100,000 women in 5 years. At 15? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where, how did that come about?
So there are five. So to invest in entrepreneurial companies right now, you have to be accredited. And accredited means you make $200,000 a year in income or $300,000 with a spouse, or that you have $1 million in assets minus your home. So that's a federal requirement to let you invest in entrepreneurial companies. There are 5 million of us that meet, 5 million women that meet that number. A tiny, tiny number have ever invested in an entrepreneurial company. So my goal is to educate a million women on what this is about, backing these, you know, new young companies that we want in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And I expect to have 100,000 investing every year. And that's just the beginning.
And you think you will, by the way. I have no doubt that you will.
Wonderful.
No doubt. Yeah. You know, I want to know what you look for in a potential, you know, company that you feel is going to be successful. What are some of the things that you look for in both the founder and the company itself at the very beginning?
We want the fire in the belly.
Okay.
We want to know that they are they're resilient, that they have a vision for creating something that does not exist today. We want to know that on top of that vision, that they have the execution, you know, either expertise or plan to take that big vision and get it down to, this is what I need to do this quarter, you know, this 6 months, this year, next year, to actually be able to see that vision come to life. We like, you know, kind of the major roles to be covered with that. So if it's in the sciences or healthcare, we want to see that they have the proper medical, mm-hmm. you know, expertise as well, or if it's in tech, that's critical. We want them to be addressing a big market. You can make a lot of mistakes if you have a big enough market. So we want to know that it's a big enough market, a big enough idea. We want the product to be unique. We don't want to have seen 20 or 30 of these in the past. We want something, you know, that's going to, you know, really attract people. We want to know that there's enough money in it that they actually can sell this, and that they can sell it to, you know, that large market and grow rapidly. And we want them to exit it at some point, to be able to sell it, because that's how we make our money. You know, we only make our, unlike a bank where you pay back a loan, when you invest, you only make your money when that company either goes public or it's acquired by somebody or merges with another company. So we want to know that all of those things work. And all of my lead investors in my funds all understand all that dynamic. And not only do they understand that, but for all those small individual investors, they take it as their responsibility to help all of them understand it. Even though they're not making the final decisions, we just take it as our goal to make sure that we all kind of can you know, understand how to filter or source for great opportunities. And Sue, a lot of the best companies I see come from my individual investors who have, you know, have met someone or seen someone speak or seen a product, and they call me or email me and say, oh my gosh, you need to see this company. You need to meet this entrepreneur.
That's so exciting. How many do you have right now? What's your number of investors?
So we have over 300.
Okay.
In our funds, mm-hmm. we have over 3,000 on platform, on the portfolio.com platform, looking to get into the next fund, our next, you know, or a fund that they like, because they're in different verticals. Our next fund is launching next week, and it's the Femtech Fund, or Women's Health, which is a huge area.
Yes.
You know, because 95% of VCs are men. You know, they tell me they don't like to do icky things. You know, if you have to say vagina, they're not necessarily going to jump on that deal. So we have, it's a huge area.
Yeah.
Everything from menopause to fertility to, you know, birth, childbirth, and you know, just general health and well-being. So
yeah,
that's going to be a great fund.
You know, Trish, I want to just get back to you for a little bit. We have just a moment left. And, you know, your lifelong passion has been really in supporting and investing in innovative entrepreneurs and helping women personally and professionally. And, you know, a quote, you said something about helping women unlock these talents. Tell me what you think your own personal talent is that has allowed you to really, you know, just what you have accomplished, I think, is touching so many women. It's vast. What is it about you that has allowed you to do that?
I think it's that I have the ability to see opportunities in a world that are not here yet, and I'm not afraid to put the creative work together to make them live, you know, bring them to fruition.
Yeah, I love that. That would be vision and courage, I think, sums you up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I accepted it.
Yeah, thanks, Trish. We have to go, and I appreciate your time and sharing your story with us, and we're going to be following all the work.
Thank you, Sue. Appreciate being with you.
Thank you. That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Have a great week.